The United Nations says Israel has demolished some 45 Palestinian structures in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds in the past 2 weeks. Iran's president rules out the possibility of holding talks with the U.S. president in New York, saying that Biden's policies are no different from those of his predecessor. The British government's move to invite Saudi Crown Prince MBS to Queen Elizabeth's funeral raises controversy. Live from our Tehran headquarters, this is World News with me, your host, Behrouz Najafi. It's good to have you with us. The Israeli regime keeps destroying Palestinian homes as part of its land grab policy. According to the United Nations, Tel Aviv authorities have destroyed 44 homes in the occupied West Bank, including in Al-Quds, in just the past 2 weeks, around 20 of them without any prior notice. As a result of the latest demolitions, dozens of Palestinians have become homeless. Israel routinely destroys Palestinian structures for lack of permits that are next to impossible to obtain. It also destroys the homes of Palestinians who are involved in anti-Israel operations. Human rights campaigners call the move a collective punishment. The demolitions are also seen as parts of efforts to make room for illegal settlements. Okay, for more information from Ramallah, let's bring in our correspondent, Mona Kandil, for further details. Mona, some of these, again, they're citing a lack of permits. Some of them have been given notice. Some of them have not even been given prior notice.
Yes, that's right. Between the period 30 of August until September, as you have mentioned, 44 Palestinian homes had been destroyed in Area C of the occupied West Bank that is supposed to be under Palestinian Authority control or under the Palestinian control and part of the future Palestinian state, and some 9 or 12 homes were demolished in Al-Quds. Israeli claims these homes or the owners of these homes didn't get Israeli issued permits before building their structures. We have to mention that at the time Israel destroys the homes for lack of Israeli issued permits, they do not give Palestinians Israeli issued permits. They reject to give Palestinians these needed permits in Area C under full Israeli military control, as well as in Al-Quds. At the same time, they allow the Israeli settlers to expand their homes to build the new settler units. The main reason, or the real reasons, for the ongoing demolition of Palestinian homes for the lack of Israeli issued permits is because Israel wants to confiscate the lands, give it to nearby illegal settlements to expand the settlements or build in new settler settlements or settler units, or even for using these lands for military purpose, or even to open new settler, only settler roads, so Palestinians are forced to leave their homes in order to allow the settlers to build new settler units. We have to mention that in Al-Quds mainly, the Israelis give the Palestinians two choices. Either the Israeli regime, of course, destroy their homes, and of course Palestinian owners would be paying for the Israeli regime high fines, or they themselves have to destroy their own homes.
Okay, thanks for that. Mona Kandil, our correspondent in Ramallah. We've been discussing the latest regional and global developments with the Deputy Secretary General of Lebanon's resistance movement, Hezbollah. One of the issues inevitably raised was the status and the fate of the Tel Aviv regime. Now, Sheikh Naim Qasem says the resistance has been going from strength to strength, and Israel is no longer a determining force in conflicts or wars. He added that while the regime used to wage battles outside the occupied territories, it now has to fight them inside Israel. Sheikh Qasem said that resistance missiles can now reach every point in the occupied Palestine, including Tel Aviv. He said that Israel's biggest ally, the U.S., is also seeing its influence wane. He noted that the U.S. has lost all the wars and battles it's launched in recent times, including those in Afghanistan, Iraq, and Syria. The The Sheikh also pointed out that U.S. sanctions against countries like Iran, Cuba, and Venezuela have all failed. We'll broadcast the full interview Sunday on Press TV's Insight program. You can also watch it on our website, presstv.ir. The Secretary General of Lebanon's Hezbollah movement says the resistance group will not allow the Israeli regime to extract oil and natural gas from an energy field off the Lebanese coast until the maritime dispute is resolved.
What is important is that there is no extraction from Karish, which continues to be disputed, until we draw the maritime borders before Lebanon has its rightful demands. We will not allow the extraction of petrol and gas from the Karish fields, the disputed Karish fields, before Lebanon gets its rightful rights for us. The red line is the beginning of the extraction of petrol and gas from Karish.
In a speech on the annual Arbaeen commemoration, Nasrallah underlined that Hezbollah is neither issuing any threat nor does it want any conflict, but he said that he wants Lebanon's maritime rights to be secured. Nasrallah urged Palestinians, the regional countries, and all resistance groups and organizations to join hands against the Tel Aviv regime and reclaim their rights, land, and resources. The Hezbollah chief also touched upon the 1982 massacre of Palestinian refugees in Sabra and Shatila camps in Beirut. He called it Israel's most heinous crime, in which Lebanese militia, armed by the regime, stormed the camps and brutally killed thousands of civilians. Nasrallah said that Israel has not been held accountable decades after committing the horrible crime. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution has praised ceremonies of the Arbaeen commemoration, including the millions-strong annual march on the Iraqi holy city of Karbala. Speaking in a commemoration service attended by students, Ayatollah Khamenei said that the Arbaeen march is a miraculous event which signifies God Almighty's will to keep the flag of Islam flying. The move, the leader says, is not driven by any man-made policies or measures. Rather, he added that it's the divine power which, through this large-scale manifestation, opens a bright road ahead of us. Ayatollah Khamenei said that ill-wishers and those distorting realities are making relentless efforts to launch campaigns against key Islamic events such as the Arbaeen March. The leader also urged all to be patient and remain steadfast in treading the path of righteousness. The number of pilgrims attending the great religious gathering of Arbaeen in Iraq has surpassed expectations. A correspondent has a report from the Iraqi city of Karbala that hosts the holy shrine of Imam Hussein.
Millions of people from all over the world travel to the Iraqi city of Karbala every year to mark Arbaeen. That's the 40th day after the martyrdom anniversary of Imam Hussein, the third Shia Imam and the grandson of the Prophet Muhammad. The pilgrims visit the shrine of Imam Hussein and his half-brother, Abbas. This pilgrimage is the world's largest religious gatherings. A considerable number of pilgrims opt to travel on foot, starting their journey from the holy city of Najaf, the resting place of Imam Hussein's father, Imam Ali. They then walk 80 kilometers to reach Karbala. Their love for Imam Hussein, who symbolizes freedom and justice in Islam, is the main motive that takes them through the hardships of this long journey.
If you believe in humanity, if you believe in such humanity, you have to look at the views of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. He comes out for humanity. He comes out to empower the truth upon the lies. He comes out to empower humanity.
I came all this way because for the sacrifice of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. Imam Hussein is my role model, is my biggest inspiration. He stood on the lands of Karbala all alone, and we are here today to chant Labbaik Ya Hussein.
To facilitate the pilgrimage, local volunteers as well as foreigners set up mokips, makeshift stalls and clinics along the roads to provide essentials such as food, water and healthcare.
We welcome all pilgrims of Imam Hussein, whether they are Iranian or Arab, Muslim or Christian. We welcome anyone who believes in Hussein. We provide them warm veils for pilgrims, and it's an honor for us to serve them.
It's our honor to give services to pilgrims of Imam Hussein. Our goal is to help pilgrims, and that's our priority.
Well, there were reports of problems such as shortage of water and mistreatment of pilgrims. However, pilgrims' experience was rather different.
Iranian and Arab pilgrims are treated equally. I have not seen any discrimination. Iraqis did their best to serve the pilgrims of Imam Hussein just like the previous years. They have shared everything they had with others.
People from various countries with different backgrounds travel to Karbala for Arba'in. This shows that Imam Hussein does not belong to a single community, nation, or religion. Therefore, Arba'in has truly become a manifestation of unity and brotherhood. Ati Abbasian, Karbala.
Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi has ruled out the possibility of having a meeting or holding talks with his U.S. counterpart, Joe Biden, during his upcoming trip to New York.
You're off to New York. You're going to speak at the United Nations. You know, President Biden is going to be there. Are you open to a meeting with President Biden, a face-to-face?
No, I don't think that such a meeting would happen. I don't believe having a meeting or talk with him will be beneficial.
Well, Raisi said that there is no difference between the administrations of Joe Biden and his predecessor Donald Trump, because Biden has performed the same policies. The Iranian president is scheduled to address the 77th session of the UN General Assembly in the coming days. Back in 2018, Trump launched a so-called maximum pressure campaign against Iran after pulling out of a 2015 deal known as the JCPOA and reimposing anti-Tehran sanctions. Iran says that the JCPOA revival hinges upon the removal of sanctions and guarantees that Washington won't exit the deal again as it did before. The British government is facing a barrage of criticism for inviting Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman to attend Queen Elizabeth's funeral. The criticism centers around bin Salman's role in the murder and dismemberment of distant Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi. His fiancée is calling for bin Salman to be arrested for murder when he arrives in London. Hatice Cengiz says that the Saudi crown prince should be denied the opportunity to seek legitimacy and normalization by attending the queen's funeral. Rights campaigners also citing excessive domestic repression and Saudi's deadly war against Yemen. London-based Campaign Against Arms Trade says that the occasion gives the MBS another chance to whitewash his human rights record. The Bahrain Institute for Rights and Democracy is echoing similar concerns. The institute has called bin Salman a notorious Persian Gulf despot who presides over appalling violations against dissidents. Shock and outrage has spread across the British black community as an investigation into the police shooting of an unarmed black man in South London has just begun. Chris Cabot was killed at the beginning of the month, and his death has many activists claiming it was an unjust killing by a racist police force. Robert Carter reports at the latest protest in London.
British police have found themselves embroiled in another racism scandal, this time surrounding the killing of an unarmed black man in South London by armed officers on the 5th of September. Following an alleged police pursuit, 24-year-old Chris Carver was behind the wheel of a car hemmed in by two police vehicles in a narrow street before one round was fired, ending his life. He leaves behind a fiancée and an unborn child. No gun was found in the car.
Thousands of protesters have descended outside police headquarters in central London to vent their fury over what they say is gross injustice being carried out by the authorities against Chris and his family. Accusations are swirling around, some of which include that the police who stopped Chris on that fateful day may have known who was inside the car in the lead-up to the fatal shooting. This is, of course, all being investigated, but the protest organisers have made absolutely clear that they are going to refuse to back down until the demands of the family are met and justice be served.
Fighting back the tears, family members spoke of their ordeal after seeing the body for the first time since the killing. News of the shooting has caused uproar, especially in the black community. They feel this was just another example of a racist system out to harm them.
Do you know what? Thank goodness that they've decided not to arm the entire police force, because if that was the case, then I think that would be a cause for concern. Because obviously they're demonstrating themselves to be quite trigger happy.
Following the backlash, the officer responsible for the shooting has been suspended. An investigation is also underway, but the police watchdog warned it could take 9 months to reach a conclusion. The family expressed anger at the lengthy wait. However, the question of race playing a role will be examined as a factor, providing some small hope that the family's demands will be answered. Robert Carter, London.
There seems to be no end in sight to the war in Ukraine that's approaching its 7th month. The U.S.'s unwavering support, especially in the form of weapons, continues unabated. One thing not mentioned or covered as much is the use of private military contractors. The notorious Blackwater, renamed Academia now, is the most well-known accused of participating in the Ukraine conflict. The firm was also responsible for the Nisour Square massacre in Iraq 15 years ago.
It was a massacre that was unprecedented, and it highlighted how private U.S. military contractors felt that they were above the law. 15 years ago, military contractors shot and killed 17 Iraqis, including 2 children. The massacre, which became known as the Nisour Square Massacre, highlighted what can go wrong when private military contractors are used, especially when it comes to accountability. The U.S. used private military contractors heavily in Iraq and in Afghanistan. Now the new theater of war is Ukraine. Here is an ad for hiring these contractors. Wanted: multilingual former soldiers willing to covertly head into Ukraine for the handsome sum of up to $2,000 per day. Yes, demand is soaring, and there are plenty of people who are signing up. But what are they called? Contractors? Volunteers? Mercenaries? Or paid security workers? Obviously, some are former soldiers with the ability to fight and kill. This leaves plenty of room for mistakes, meaning civilian casualties. Remember when Ukraine's president made this announcement? Zelensky reveals number of foreign volunteers for Ukraine. The first of some 16,000 fighters to have already arrived, the Ukrainian president said. He further added, Ukraine continues to receive weaponry on a daily basis from our partners, from real friends. And the weapons are more and more powerful every day. The very same weapons that are given to these volunteers. So far, the number of so-called volunteers to have joined the Ukrainian armed forces could be as high as 20,000, a figure that could even exceed that. The demographics of these fighters are varied. In all, fighters from Eastern Europe and former Soviet republics constitute the majority of fighters. In terms of Western countries, the greatest number of foreign fighters include the US, UK, Canada, Germany, France, and even some that are coming from Japan.
That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Listeners Special. In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. Salam, dear listeners, and warm greetings to you all. Welcome to this week's edition of Listeners Special on this Sunday, September 18, 2022. I'm Atefe Erfani, hosting this program today. Here, on behalf of all IRIB English radio staff, I express my condolences on the occasion of Arba'in, which this year happened to be yesterday, September 17th. For your information, Arba'in is 40th day after the martyrdom of Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, as well as his companions, in the year 61 AH. Stay with us, please. This is Listeners Special, and Listeners Special is the Sunday program where your views are presented through emails, letters, and messages. So please contact us and tell us what you think about IRIB English radio programs. And if you have any message for our listeners around the world, you can record your voice, send it to us, and get your voice heard in this program. Please do remember, Listeners Special is your program. It's your views that are important. Welcome back, and as usual, many of you have taken the trouble of sending us reception reports. These reception reports are very helpful to us, especially to our technicians and engineers. These reception reports actually enable us to provide a better service to our listeners around the world. All of you who have sent in a reception report will be receiving an electronic QSL card from us. And here, I truly appreciate those of our listeners who have kindly sent us reception reports, including Ivan Zeleny from Russia, Najmuddin from India, and David Moby from Finland. And of course, we've received many emails from around the world, which I mentioned some of their names here, and later during the program, I will read these emails. Mohammad Khaku from the US has sent us an email on the occasion of Arba'in. Eddie Witanto from Indonesia, one of our old and regular listeners, has sent us an email. From Italy, we've received an email from Simone Santini. And the last but not the least is an email from Rob den Boer from the Netherlands. Please stay with us. Welcome back. This is Listeners Special, and here we have an email from Mohammad Khaku from the US. Mohammad Khaku says, "The concept of pilgrimage exists in all major religions. However, not many know about the pilgrimage to Iraq and the walk from the city of Najaf to Karbala on the occasion of Arba'in. 40 days after the martyrdom anniversary of Shia's third Imam, Imam Hussein, peace upon him, millions of Muslim worshippers converge in Iraq's holy city of Karbala as part of the annual pilgrimage. Imam Hussein, the grandson of the Prophet of Islam, Prophet Muhammad, peace upon him, was martyred in Karbala on a day which became known as Ashura, the 10th day of the Islamic month of Muharram, having refused to pledge allegiance to the corrupt and tyrannical caliph of the time, Yazid. In the day of Arba'in, Shia and Sunni Muslims, even Christians, partake in both the pilgrimage as well as serving of devotees. No such an event exists in the world with such a frequency and magnitude. This is the largest peaceful gathering which many people probably never heard of it, and many Western media have failed to cover or deliberately censor. Arbaeen is newsworthy because of a unique and exceptional 55-mile walk. Millions will walk for 3 days during the day and night time with the scorching desert sun bearing down upon them. The volunteers, doctors, and devotees distribute free food and drinks by the roadside and have tents for medical attention, relaxing, sleeping, and washing. The event of Arbaeen is largely self-organizing. However, the event is well secured and superbly managed by the authorities. The mood of the pilgrimage is one of intense piety, unity, and solidarity. First of all, salam and warm greetings to you, Muhammad Khaku from the US, and many thanks for writing this email to us, actually this detailed email to us. You gave us great information about the occasion of Arbaeen. Recently, I had a trip to Karbala, Iraq, and participated in the ceremony. And what you described actually came in front of my eyes. It's a really great event. I cannot describe it, and words really fail me in describing this event. Muhammad Khaku from the US, again, thank you for writing this great email to us. Please write to us soon. My colleagues will soon send you an electronic QSL card to you as verification. And after a short break, I will be back with you. Welcome back. Eddie Witanto from Indonesia, one of our old and regular listeners, has sent us an email. Let's see what Eddie says. Many thanks for your quick reply to the listeners. I'm very glad to read your email. I know Iran since long time. When I was only a child, my father would often refer to the word Persia. Later, I found out that it means the country which we now know as Iran. So, for me, Iran is not only dear and famous for its carpet, but also is interesting for me for its historical relationship with my country. First of all, salam and warm greetings to you from Tehran, the Islamic Republic of Iran, and IRIB English Radio to you, Eddie Witanto from Indonesia. Please accept our warm gratitude to you for writing this email to us. It's great that you know about Iran. IRIB English Radio is a good source of information for you, Eddie Witanto from Indonesia, to know more about the land of Iran, about the Iranian people, and the developments in our country, the Islamic Republic of Iran. Eddie Witanto from Indonesia, many thanks again. Write to us soon and tell us your views about IRIB English Radio programs. And here we've received an email from Simone Santini from Italy. Let's see what Simone says. Dear staff, I have a very great pleasure in sending you a reception report about your English broadcast I heard a few days ago. I'm using a receiver with a long wire antenna. My station is located in Prato, central Italy. I listened to the music followed by news program in which the speaker mentioned Italy and various facts regarding energy and gas cost. Also, I listened to a program about an Iranian national hero in the time of British occupation, which I enjoyed a lot. Hoping you will confirm this report. Best regards from Italy. Salam and warm greetings to you from Tehran, the Islamic Republic of Iran. Simone Santini from Italy, and please accept our appreciations to you for writing this email to us. It's also a pleasure for us to receive a reception report from you, Simone. My colleagues will soon send you an electronic QSL card as a verification. We wish you all the best, and we are so happy that the signals of IRIB English Radio is received by you and in your region, Simone. And we are so glad that you told us your views about IRIB English Radio programs, including the programs, as you said, that was about an Iranian national hero in the time of British occupation, as well as programs about various facts regarding energy and gas costs around the world. So please accept our appreciations to you. We're looking forward to hearing from you very soon, Simone Santini from Italy. And after a short break, I will be back with you. Welcome back. Rob Den Boer from the Netherlands has sent us an email. Rob says, "Dear friends at IRIB English Radio, my name is Rob Den Boer and I live in the city of Hainaut, Netherlands. It is with pleasure that I hereby confirm your broadcast. Please listen to audio file attached. If this report is accepted as correct, please send me your verification. Thank you so much." Salam and greetings to you, Rob Den Boer from the Netherlands, one of our regular listeners, and thank you very much for sending this email to us. We are glad that our signals are heard in your region, in your city, Hainaut, Netherlands. We are looking forward to hearing from you very soon, and please accept our EQSL card as a verification. And here we come to the end of this edition of Listeners Special. But before saying goodbye, I, on behalf of all IRIB English Radio staff, express my condolences on the occasion of Arba'in, which this year happened to be yesterday, September 17th. And for your information, Arba'in is the 40th day after the martyrdom of Imam Hussein, peace upon him, as well as his companions, in the year 61 AH. Many thanks for being with us. Please keep in touch with us. Have a good time and goodbye.
Listeners, your opinion is always important to us. We invite you to spend just a few minutes writing us a letter or sending us an email. We'll be glad to hear from all of our listeners who have any questions or comments about any of our programs. Our postal address is IRIB English Service, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran. You can also send your emails to EnglishRadio@irib.ir. That is one word, EnglishRadio@irib.ir. Please visit our website at www.pasttoday.com/en. Our phone number is 00981-2201-3720. Once again, our phone number is 00981-2201-3720. Our profile is also in Facebook. Our address is www.facebook.com/pasttodayenglish. Thank you all.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hezbollah's Secretary General has yet again issued a stern warning to Israel. Lebanon will not permit Israel to extract oil and gas from Karish gas and oil field before the resolution of a maritime dispute. The resistance movement has said this is not a threat, that it only wants what rightfully belongs to Lebanon. Could this spell the beginning of yet another conflict between Israel and Lebanon? Well, in this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at the tensions between Israel and Lebanon on this matter, one in which the gas field also belongs to the Palestinians in the Gaza Strip as well. First, let me introduce our guests for this edition of The Spotlight. Director of the Institute of Contemporary Islamic Thought, Zafar Bangash, joins us from Toronto. Also joining us, Assistant Professor of Middle East Studies at the University of Tehran, Arya Barzan Mohammadi, who joins us from Tehran.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
I'd like to welcome to you both. Let me first start with our guest there in Toronto. We're looking at what the Hezbollah Secretary General has said in terms of what he said is not a warning, but basically he just wants what is rightfully for Lebanon, and that is the rights of Lebanon to this gas field. How do you view this situation, given that this dispute now is going on for quite some time?
Yes, well, as far as Hezbollah Secretary General Sayyed Hassan Nasrallah's position is concerned, it is absolutely correct. He is asserting Lebanese rights, which should have been done by the Lebanese government, but unfortunately, the Lebanese government is quite weak. The Lebanese army is unable to implement the rights of the Lebanese people, and so the Hezbollah Secretary General has stepped in. This has actually been going on for quite a while. In fact, as far back as February of 2018, Hezbollah had entered into an agreement with a number of oil companies. These are Western consortium comprising of Total, Eni, and Novatek to explore oil in that area. But then, regrettably, through UN manipulation, Israel used the United States and other Western countries to limit the area that Lebanon's maritime limit is in the Mediterranean Sea. And so this dispute arose at that time. And so Hezbollah has said that if its rights, that means the rights of the Lebanese people, are not respected and guaranteed, then nobody would be able to extract oil and gas from that region, referred to as the Karish field. It's also, the Kanaf project as well, part of it. So this area that comprises several thousand square kilometers, is essentially the area that is under dispute, and Hezbollah wants that resolved before any oil and gas can be extracted from there.
We're going to get into some of those details, but what is somewhat bizarre in a sense, I'm not too sure if I'm using the right word, Mr. Mohammadi, and that is the fact that we're looking at this gentleman, Amos Hochstein, the U.S. mediator for indirect talks on this border demarcation that's happening between Lebanon and Israel, which at this point, though he has tried, it appears to come up with an amicable initiative for both to move on. And there seems to have maybe been some breakthroughs, as it was reported, but nothing tangible yet. The first question, and this may have been answered, but the first question is, how did a U.S. official get involved in mediation between Israel and Lebanon? That is something that plagues the some say, the outcome of these talks.
Well, that shows that there is a bigger and larger geopolitical game on the table than the simple dispute between the Zionist regime and the Lebanese government. As you rightly have pointed out, Hochstein is involved since 2018, at least, and Americans are involved. And the thing is, the occupying regime is hoping to build a gas pipeline under the sea, starting even from Egypt, from the Zohr gas fields of Egypt, then joining it to Leviathan gas fields near Gaza, and then also joining maybe Karish gas fields, and then taking it to Cyprus, Greece, and Europe. So this is the big plan according to their roadmap. On the other hand, they are trying to, in a way, follow some normalization steps with the Lebanese government, which Hezbollah rightly so is resisting. And the normalization comes with some sort of offers of joint venture and also joint projects and also some concessions. They know that the Lebanese government is under financial pressure. And that's also because of the policies of U.S. and some GCC countries. So they are trying to entangle the Lebanese government and Hezbollah in a game of plots and mischievous policies, but I'm sure that Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah is a clever leader, and he monitors the both diplomatic moves by Yair Lapid last week in Egypt, in Germany and France, and also the moves on the sea and the building of platform. And this is why they are sending their drones, unarmed drones, to show that if needed, Hezbollah is more than ready and capable to arm those drones. And also Hezbollah, currently speaking, is standing behind the Lebanese government and Najib Negati up until the point that they are defending the Lebanese national interest. And if they were successful in, gaining all the benefits that the Lebanese people hope from this gas field, then Hezbollah wouldn't disagree with them. But if they were unsuccessful in securing Lebanese interests, then Hezbollah will take other measures, I'm sure.
Sure. Now here's where the crust of the thrust of the problem is. Zafar Bangash, if I may look at it that way, I'm just looking at a very simple outlook here, and that is, obviously, these are not fields that are visible to the eye, per se. So you can't really go and just look and say, okay, this part is mine, this part is yours. The Lebanese demanded 860 square kilometers, to get a little technical here, of territory, and that was according to a map that was sent to the UN back in the year 2011. Now, Lebanon has said that that map was actually erroneous in its calculations. So it went ahead. They had companies, Lebanese companies now, it's important, that extracted the maritime area's resources and figured out the dimensions. But then they said that they were threatened by the United States and Israel. So who then can come out and make some exact dimensions that can be accredited and then authorized and then verified and then agreed upon by both parties. You know, that sounds like a Herculean task.
Well, absolutely, yes. But I think there are certain international maritime laws that determine the maritime boundaries of various states around the sea. And it is based on that Hezbollah is making its position quite clear, because regrettably, the Lebanese government, as I mentioned right at the beginning, is rather weak, and it's unable to assert the rights of the Lebanese people. And so unless and until, this issue of the maritime boundaries is established, then, developing these oil fields, et cetera, or gas fields would make no sense, because this problem would continue. And in this sense, what Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah said was that before any exploration takes place, that the maritime boundaries have to be established, demarcated, and established according to international law. And in that sense, since the Zionist regime was trying to play dirty, Hezbollah actually sent a warning in the sense of sending some unarmed drones over that region, over the sea, to show to the Zionists that Hezbollah is quite capable of carrying out operations if the Zionists were to act in a way that would undermine the interests of the Lebanese people. And the Zionists have actually got the message. That's why this American Amos Hochstein has been involved in indirect negotiations, because obviously, Hezbollah would not negotiate with the Zionist regime directly. There was also a report some days ago in Al Rai newspaper that a Middle Eastern envoy has been going back and forth, and he met the Hezbollah Secretary General, requesting him or communicating to him a message from the Israelis that this dispute needs to be deferred for a while until the Israeli elections take place. And the response from Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah was very forthright. He said, we are not interested in what the Zionists do, their internal affairs, their elections, etc. To us, it makes absolutely no difference who is in power. They are all outlaws, they are all oppressors, and they perpetrate horrific crimes against the Palestinian people. They usurp the territory of other people. And so we are here to assert our rights, and we demand those rights to be respected. Otherwise, the consequences would have to be borne by the Zionists.
So based on that, then, Mr. Mohammadi, do you think that Israel may be wanting to play somewhat of a delaying tactic, given the fact, for example, the immediate or short term would be the elections, as our guests are indicated? And then overall, when it takes a look at Lebanon's obviously economy is suffering, and energy resources is something that it needs extremely badly for its country. And given that, the U.S. and Israel may be using Lebanon's poor state of the economy, to try to not only get concessions, but to give them time to maybe have ulterior motives in this whole scenario, and that is to create instability within Lebanon, maybe.
I agree with you that the Israelis would prefer to delay this issue for a while. One reason or cause is the upcoming election in Israel. And the other one is the failure of Yair Lapid in convincing European leader to invest in this project. They were hoping that because of the Ukraine war, the EU would be very much interested in investing heavily on the gas projects of Israel. But the EU have rejected this for various reasons. One of them is that it will take a long time for any gas field in the Mediterranean, southern and eastern Mediterranean region to be utilized at a level that could replace even 10% of the Russian gas. And the Qatari gas is much more viable option than the Mediterranean one. The other one is that the Europeans prefer to use LNG facilities in Cairo, in Egypt, in order to import LNG gas from the Mediterranean. And this is because they don't want to become independent from the Russian gas and then make themselves under the mercy of another pipeline. So their strategic view of the issue is that use more LNG because it is more replaceable and more mobile than the pipeline. All in all, the Israeli government, the occupying regime government, have decided to put a pause on this issue for a while. But as your guest from Toronto has rightly said so, Hezbollah is not interested in any internal Israeli politics, and they regard this as an utmost issue of national security, and we know that Lebanese government and Lebanese society are in dire need for energy, for fuel, and they wouldn't agree to any deal that would neglect the national interest of Lebanon and the rights of Lebanese people to secure their territorial rights in the sea and under the sea and the gas fields. So I think that all the negotiation tactics wouldn't amount to anything tangible in the short term, but in the medium term or the long term, I believe that the U.S. Policy or plan is to use this negotiation as an introduction for some sort of normalization, but in the region. But I'm sure that Hezbollah has a response for every card that the U.S. tries to play in this regard, and it will use the right tactic at the right time and place.
That's interesting. Trying to figure out the U.S. strategy here. Zafar Bangash, perhaps you can help me out with what our guests there indicated about it being in the framework of this so-called normalization. And at the same time, we're looking at a statement made by the U.S. President Joe Biden in August, which is not that long ago, when he discussed this with Yair Lapid. And Joe Biden said and emphasized the importance of concluding these talks and negotiations in the coming weeks. Why do you think there was an assistance by Biden to make sure that this got wrapped up in a rather short period of time, you think?
Well, basically because the Israelis are in a terrible bind, and so is Biden, actually. If we look at American situation, congressional elections are coming up next month. And Biden obviously is under tremendous pressure because he has achieved absolutely nothing in terms of any foreign policy objectives. And there are fears that the Democrats might lose quite heavily in the forthcoming congressional elections. So if Biden were to be able to achieve some kind of an agreement between Israel and Lebanon fairly quickly, then he can present that as a feather in his cap, because the Zionist lobby is very powerful inside the United States. So that's one dimension of it. The other, of course, is that in Israel itself, there is a lot of pressure on the Zionist regime. The Zionists are not able to control the situation. I mean, we saw at the beginning of August, there was a flare-up of attacks against the Gaza Strip, which lasted for 3 days. And yet, the Palestinians, particularly Palestinian Islamic Jihad movement, was able to impose certain conditions on the Zionists that they had to accept, which was, for instance, the release of prisoners that are held under so-called administrative detention. We know of Khalil Awawde, who ended his hunger strike a few weeks ago because of the pressure that was built up. And then there are other hundreds of other prisoners that are also being held under administrative detention. Then we see that in the West Bank itself, Jenin has emerged as a very strong resistance point to the Zionist occupiers. And so the Zionists are under tremendous pressure. The Palestinians, by the simple fact that they have not given up despite all of this pressure, is putting tremendous strain on the Zionists. And they are unable to come up with any other answers to a situation that they clearly see is getting out of their hands completely. So it is in this context that obviously Joe Biden was anxious both for his own party's standing in the forthcoming congressional elections, as well as for the Zionists that are facing this tremendous pressure mm-hmm. inside their own territory.
Okay, one thing we haven't talked about, and it's not really talked about that often when this issue comes up, and that is the Gaza Strip and the Palestinians and their right to the natural gas, which was found off the shore of the Gaza Strip back in the year 2000. And based on the records, it was licensed to British Gas by the Palestinian National Authority back then. So if we want to take a look at the Palestinians, Chairman Mr. Mohammed, how do you feel that can be defended in order for them to gain their right? Said Hassan Nasrallah on a few occasions has said that we will come to the defense of the Palestinians in the Gaza Strip for their rightful share of the resources there. Do you think that a chance will exist for the Palestinians to actually get a right to that?
Well, Palestinians, especially in Gaza, they are surprising the world at every time they get in a war with the Zionist regime. So whether they have, several wild cards or surprising tactics in their sleeves, we have to wait and see. But I wouldn't be surprised if they would reveal some new ammunitions or new weapons that could change the game, the plan in the region. The thing is, currently speaking, the Lebanese Hezbollah doesn't have a navy in order to impose things on the Zionist regime. So the most thing they can do is to defend the Lebanese territorial rights in the sea. But for the Palestinians, I think if the Palestinians in Gaza and West Bank, if they decide to resist this looting of the Palestinian wealth, and if they try to show resistance by several means, I'm sure Hezbollah then would be able to come to their aid one way or another. But the thing is, at the moment, people in Gaza are living under a blockade situation. They have problems for securing their food and water, and even their security. They are assassinated from time to time. Their leaders are assassinated. The young men are arrested and put on jail. So with regard to the energy situation in the Mediterranean and the right of Palestinians for access to this wealth, I hope that the future will have good news and some surprises in this regard as well for the whole region.
Thank you very much for that. Assistant Professor of Middle East Studies at the University of Tehran, Arya Barzan Mohammadi there, and Director of the Institute of Contemporary Islamic Thought, Zafar Bangash. Thank you from Toronto. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikova Tapway and the team, his goodbye until next time.